Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute of Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and the good folks here at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Interim Director for the Institute, and I'm joined, as always, by our economist, Dr. Charlie Ballard, who directs our State of the State survey. Later on, we'll be joined by Dr. Charlissa Moore, an assistant professor in MSU's James Madison College and College of Engineering, to talk about a recent report released on energy. But before we speak to Dr. Moore, let's dive into some of the topics of the day. Charlie, the federal government shutdown has just ended, and I'm wondering if we are aware or know how the shutdown impacted Michigan in particular.
Good news is that the shutdown didn't hurt Michigan as much as it hurt the Washington, D.C., Maryland, Northern Virginia area. But still, we've got several thousand federal employees here in Michigan. Longer lines at airports because of Transportation Security Administration folks calling in sick. We've had some federal grants involving some of our universities where part of the grant application process had to be delayed because of this. So we didn't take as much of a bullet as D.C., but still, I think it was a substantial effect. And if there's any good news in this, at least it's over, at least for now.
And what about hits to the economy in general across the country? I know it seems as if the debacle over air travel finally was the tipping point in getting something done. Was there any ripple effects throughout the economy? Certainly it seemed as if Wall Street was continuing to do its roller coaster ride, and really I can't say where I saw that it responded either negatively or positively to the shutdown.
Well, it is hard to distinguish since financial markets have been pretty volatile really for the last year, going back quite a ways, hard to distinguish how much of an effect that partial government shutdown may have had. But I think for the longer term, it has to be damaging because businesses like certainty. They like predictability. And now we've shown a federal government that seems really dysfunctional. I mean, in recent decades, of course, it's often seemed dysfunctional, but this one was dysfunctional exclamation point. And I think that private markets, equity markets, that kind of stuff drives them crazy. Because they just don't know whether they're going to be able to count on a stable policy environment.
Now, since the last time we were on, a new governor has taken office, Governor Whitmer. She's made many of her department appointments, and she has a State of the State address coming up. And who knows, it could come even before the State of the Union finally gets done. But, you know, one of the issues that Governor Whitmer talked about during the campaign was education.
Yes.
And we had a report come out last week which from Michigan State University that showed that Michigan ranks actually, after adjusted for inflation, we actually rank 50th in funding for education.
Among the 50 states. And you can't actually get any lower than 50th among 50. And we see that in education. Our students continue to rank typically in the sort of mid-30s in terms of various measures of educational attainment. We see it with the crumbling infrastructure that I think we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. We have had in Michigan really for the last several decades an obsession with lower taxes. And I don't think it's too strong to call it an obsession. And I think we see the results. The results are predictable. We have crumbling infrastructure. We have skyrocketing tuition at universities because as the funding for higher ed has been cut, the colleges have to find some way to pay their bills. We have K-12 education funding down 20% according to the report by Professor David Arson and others. It's not what I think is a pretty picture, although the politics of turning that around and finding enough revenue to do more things is very difficult.
Right. And so there's a lot on the governor's plate as she approaches that State of the State address. Education, promise to fix the roads, even though just 2 years ago the legislature supposedly came up with some methods to do that, one of which will impact her budget in the next couple of years by moving $600 million from the general fund over to roads and taking money away from programs such as education, K-12 education, higher education, cities, and other important services. So she's got a lot on the plate. She made a lot of promises. I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly what her plans are for funding K-12 education, for funding higher education, and for fixing the damn roads.
Very interesting indeed. It's a challenge, especially since she still has we have now divided government because Republicans retain control of both houses of the legislature, although their margins of control are smaller than they were before. Mm-hmm. Hopeful scenario is that there's enough pragmatic folks on both sides of the aisle to get some things done, but I don't think it's going to be easy.
No, I don't think it's going to be easy at all. And again, with a lot of those issues that are now on her plate, what are you seeing in terms of the economy moving forward? Are we going to see slower growth? Is growth going to be about the same? Because all of that certainly is going to have an impact on the state general fund, which, as we know, again, adjusted for inflation, is about the same as it was 40 years ago. So we're trying to fund all of these problems that have continued to grow with about the same bucket of money we had about 40 years ago. What are you seeing in terms of the next 6 to 12 or even 18 months in terms of economic growth?
Well, of course, predicting the macroeconomy is really really a challenge. But there's more talk of it's unquestionable that there's more talk of the possibility of a recession than there was a year or two ago. I've heard some forecasters say that they think it's possible that we could have a recession in 2019. On the plus side, if we get through to the middle of the summer, this will be the longest economic expansion in American economic history, which is good news. But that history also should give us a warning sign, because there are reasons why every previous economic expansion has eventually come to an end, and some of the warning signs are apparent now. Surging corporate debt, volatile financial markets, and then, of course, there's international factors that could adversely affect us, especially Brexit, the slowdown of the Chinese economy. I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll get through 2019 without a recession. Maybe it'll go on for several more years, but that would be ahistorical. We've never seen anything longer than 10 years. If we get to 12, that would be really, really amazing. And so we don't know exactly when the next recession will happen. We do know almost for sure that it will happen sooner or later. And when it happens, that will create budgetary challenges. And that's why I think it's very disappointing that we haven't done more during the expansion of the last decade to fix the roads, to repair mm-hmm. some of these problems that you and I were talking about.
We've technically had the money to do so.
John F. Kennedy said, the time to fix your roof is when the sun is shining.
Correct. So let me ask you just for our listeners a little bit of a clarification here, because I always have a little confusion on this, as well as many other things in my own mind, about slower growth and a recession.
So slower growth is a whole lot better than a recession.
Okay.
A recession is an actual downturn where things are shrinking. And there's a group of economists who meet regularly at the National Bureau of Economic Research, a private think tank, and they look over all sorts of economic indicators. It's not just any one thing. It's employment, it's output, and so on. And they're the ones who make the call about when we're in a recession. Recession means actually a contraction, a shrinkage of the economy. Slow growth? Well, slow growth is what we've had in this expansion.
Okay.
But slow growth is, you know, third gear or second gear is way better than reverse. It's not as good as fourth gear, but and fourth gear is what we had in the 90s. So we are now approaching an economic expansion of the same length that we've had now versus the one of the 90s, but growth has only been about half as fast.
And so what might some of those markers be to signal a downturn? Would it be, for instance, a reduction from one year to the next in auto sales?
Well, certainly auto sales are something that have an effect, and especially an important effect for Michigan. And we have seen that auto sales have been flat and are predicted to continue to be flat. So that's a sector that's already stopped growing. We are only in an economic expansion now because other things have continued to grow. If the entire economy were like the auto sector, I think we would be in a recession now.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie, as always.
Sure.
Let's now turn to Dr. Moore and talk about her research. Dr. Moore, as well as Anik Angtil, an assistant professor in civil and environmental engineering in MSU's College of Engineering, recently released a report on Michigan residents and their views on energy. And Dr. Moore was able to do that through what we call at IPSR a Michigan Applied Public Policy Research Grant. Welcome, Dr. Moore.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us a bit about your report and your findings?
I'd love to. So basically, we talked to a number of decision makers in the energy sector around Michigan, around the state capital region, and we also did a focus group with members of the public to gauge their opinions on solar power and also advanced nuclear energy designs. And then we ran our questions in the State of the State survey to understand general public opinion around issues of an energy transition, so coal, natural gas, solar, and wind. So the main takeaway that I get from our State of the State survey results is that the vast majority of the Michigan public supports an energy transition. So we saw 82% of people in support of a major transition away from coal, reducing coal use for electricity by 75%. Only 13% of the Michigan public was in opposition to that. We also found extremely high levels of support for solar and wind power, solar a little bit more than wind. So about 90% of the public supports increasing the construction of solar, and only about 5% don't. The rest are undecided. It's a little bit lower for wind, about 5% lower. So 85% of the Michigan public supports an increase in the use of wind, and only 11% opposes. We think the difference there is based on the siting controversies that have happened around wind, where wind will be placed in the landscape. And we haven't seen as much of that around solar because we haven't built as much yet. We also saw fairly high degrees of support for a transition to natural gas, with a lot of the public seeing natural gas as more environmentally friendly than coal or environmentally friendly in general. So about 70% in support of an increase of natural gas. That support comes down somewhat when we question about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. We did use the term fracking in the survey. So that decreases support for natural gas by about 46%, either somewhat or strongly. So fracking could be a major issue with a transition toward natural gas. We also asked about nuclear power. About 56% of the Michigan public opposes nuclear power. And that's about what we see for the national polling in 2017 as well, about 54% in opposition, partially correlated with a fall in oil prices and in gasoline prices. We don't really get our gasoline or our electricity from gasoline in the U.S., but it tends to sway public opinion. And we also asked a kind of leading question about whether or not the public would increase their support if we transitioned to nuclear technologies that were safer and smaller, which did increase support somewhat. We wanted to see if some of the messaging around advanced nuclear power did at least discursively sort of increase public opinion on nuclear power. I was at the Cook Nuclear Power Plant over the weekend. They just got a 20-year license extension, but for the most part, our nuclear power is being phased out. The Palisades plant just north of Cook along Lake Michigan is set to be phase out sometime in the next couple of years. So there's this question of whether or not advanced nuclear power, which is zero greenhouse gas emissions in the generation phase, could pick up some of the intermittency from solar and wind, that it's a strong baseload or flexible in some of the designs baseload power source for Michigan. We got a lot of opposition to that within the focus group. People still remembered the accident at Fermi. They remember this idea of we almost lost Detroit, which we didn't really, but that's certainly something that is justifiably scary to people. So that was something that historical memory still lasted within members of the focus group, and they were very concerned about the safety of any new nuclear power. So one of the main things that we found, both with our interviews and our survey data, is that solar, again, polls very well, but there are a lot of questions about how is it sort of arranged within our societies? Where does it go? Who owns it? Is it on people's rooftops? We found very high support for leasing of solar panels. People are very interested in that if it's available and affordable to them. But there are not really any opportunities right now on the market to be able to lease solar panels. So we see across the board in the United States that solar and wind and renewables pull very well. But it really comes down to these finer grain questions of who looks at it, who benefits from it, who gets jobs from it, who loses jobs from an energy transition, and where do they end up working instead. So it's those finer grained issues that are really where the rubber hits the road.
Everybody's in favor of cleaner energy. But then when you get to the details of, okay, that might cost something, or there might be a transition or an environmental issue or something like that in terms of the siting of the solar or wind, then it gets a little trickier.
Right, exactly.
And my perspective, too, has been that, you know, we've had the wind turbine siting controversies in Michigan now for the better part of a decade. And a lot of people are familiar with them. And now on the back end, I see less opposition to solar farm siting, given our experiences here with wind. First of all, the solar panels are not, you know, 60, 70 feet in the air. They're, you know, for the most part, unless it's the field has totally been cleared, you know, there's screening efforts that go on with the solar field. So I'm seeing, at least just from a personal perspective, less controversy with solar farm siting, given our experience with the wind siting. Now, you spoke about the perspective from around the country. I mean, you've done some of this work out in the West and the far Southwest. How can you talk about that a bit and how it compares with, you know, what you're seeing here in terms of the public view on this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my research on solar siting controversies in California and Arizona. I was looking more at large-scale solar as opposed to rooftop distributed point-of-use solar, but there was a lot of opposition from the public, particularly from the activist public in California and Arizona, around both large-scale solar photovoltaics and large-scale concentrating solar power. So these large steam turbine plants that generate electricity from the heat of the sun, whereas solar photovoltaics use the light of the sun, the photons from the sun, to produce electricity. And so there were a lot of concerns about the water use to produce the steam for the steam turbine plants, and issues of having to clean the panels, the desert dust off the panels. Also just the sort of industrial character of energy generation versus kind of open desert places that people value for spiritual reasons. In some of the sites, there were controversies with Native American groups to ancestral lands, tribal lands of spiritual significance. There were issues with the desert tortoise and rare and endangered plant species. So sort of having this trade-off between having clean energy generation and having sort of desert preservation, that was a major issue there. Everybody involved in these debates believed in climate change and wanted to mitigate it, but there were a lot of questions about, again, who should own it, who should look at it, what kind of land it should take up. And it's really this clash between instrumental values of getting clean energy in large quantities versus sort of more specific place-based sacred values of the way that people value land and landscapes. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out with solar. The big thing for solar in Michigan is to engage the public early and often, to bring in stakeholders, to consult them, to make sure that people get their voices heard and are not railroaded, but that there's a just process for locating those solar sites.
One policy combination that I think is attractive is the one that we have pursued here at Michigan State University on the southern part of the campus. We've got a lot of parking lots that have solar panels that perform a dual function. They're solar panels, but they also provide shelter for the cars that are underneath them. And so if you can get a twofer like that, there's an attractiveness to that. Anytime you can combine the solar panel with some other useful activity, I think that might be one way to help sell the public on it.
Yeah, that's the ideal way to do it, and that's what a lot of the activists in California were arguing for. So putting solar on existing built infrastructure, on landfills, on brownfield sites. It becomes very complex when we look at the broader system and different intersecting pieces of infrastructure. So, for instance, a lot of the landfill sites didn't have a transmission line that had availability nearby to be able to take the energy to load centers. Works very well on campus because we have a lot of electricity demand on campus beyond what we have demand for steam for heating our buildings. So we're running our combined heat and power plant for a lot more for electricity purposes, where it used to be just the steam heat. So now we have this surplus demand that can be met pretty well by kind of community scale renewables. But it's really having to layer this energy transition onto this existing path dependent rigid infrastructure that has a lot of sunk costs and a lot of history behind it and a lot of power behind it, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, when I came here many years ago, the pile of coal next to the TB Simon, next to our power plant here on campus, was
big.
Something to be in awe of a lot of the year. That's no longer there, as we're no longer using coal at all on campus and have a mixture of natural gas and of course now the solar. And as I hear what you're talking about and the results of your survey, it certainly seems as if the three most popular with forms of energy with the public right now and maybe moving forward is indeed natural gas, solar, and wind. Coal, despite the protestations of some in folks' minds, and even when you talk to the folks at our energy companies here in Michigan, whether it's Consumer Energy or DTE, coal is indeed becoming more and more a thing of the past. Would you say that's a correct analogy?
Yes, I think that's correct. I think that there are a lot of risks with switching all of our coal generation to natural gas. I think also we need to be mindful of the broader economic aspects of this transition and making sure that people who have dedicated their lives over a long period of time to powering the U.S. with coal have alternatives for work, and that their work is recognized as having been very important to the country. I think sometimes that gets lost in the politicization of the debate, and I don't think that that's played out very well in the election. So that's something that needs to be paid attention to. Switching entirely to natural gas has a lot of drawbacks. Fracking was one that we explored in the survey. We tend to say that it's better in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. We tend to say it's one third of the greenhouse gas emissions than coal. But that's not necessarily empirical figure that we went out and measured. That's an assumption based on the energy density of the two fuels. And we've started to see that a lot of our pipeline infrastructure and our distribution infrastructure for natural gas is leaking methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So we really need good life cycle assessment on that. Also, the water inputs into natural gas. That's one reason that even though I've been fairly skeptical and agnostic about nuclear power that I've looked into some of these Generation 4 designs, because there are options there to have a larger greenhouse gas reduction and also to use less water. I'm still kind of waiting to see if the technologists can make good on their promises and if we'll end up putting enough federal funding on the R&D side into advanced nuclear to actually get these truly advanced designs, not the AP1000s that we've seen fail in parts of the South, unfortunately, in the last couple years, but really advanced designs that would also help us to deal with the nuclear waste challenge. But I think we should be very cautious about jumping into natural gas and just replacing our coal with natural gas, because there are a lot of drawbacks and we do have alternatives. Also with battery storage becoming cheaper, with more options for deeper grid integration. In fact, we found in the survey that people want to be energy independent in Michigan, but they are open to greater grid integration with neighboring states and also with Canada if it means increasing renewable energy. So there are ways of us balancing our supply and our demand for energy on the grid without having to have baseload fossil fuels. And I think we need to explore those.
But from what I hear you saying, fossil fuels are still going to be an important part of the mix.
I think for the foreseeable future, unfortunately, I think that what we need to do is commit to a transition today and work toward that every day. If we wait, we're going to end up making investments in natural gas that will be with us for 30 or 40 years. And the cost is low right now, but with demand increasing a lot, and we don't have an unlimited amount of natural gas from shale. So I think it needs to not be our end game. If we're going to treat it as a transition fuel, we need to be very serious about making sure that we are transitioning to something cleaner and not just ending up being path dependent on natural gas.
So one more follow-up I have for you, at least that's very, very interesting work that you've done here. And what do you mean by advanced nuclear?
Yeah, it's a very complicated term. And so advanced nuclear is sometimes used to refer to the Vogtle plant, the AP1000 type reactors, one of which the company just filed for bankruptcy and ended up pulling the plug when they were $9 billion into the build. So that is just a catastrophe in terms of public policy. The ratepayers now are going to have to pay off that $9 billion, even though the power plant
is
not going to be completed.
Down south?
That's in South Carolina, okay. I believe. There's one being built in Georgia and one in South Carolina. And one they've had to pull the plug on. The other one is very uncertain, and it's backed by a federal taxpayer loan guarantee.
And how do these differ from the Fermi or the Palisades or the Cooks of the world?
So for these plants, they're kind of like a Generation 3 plant. What we want to see is Generation 4. So basically, AP1000s have better passive safety measures so that if something goes wrong, it doesn't take as much interaction by the human operators of the plant to fix it. The construction was supposed to be modular, which was part of the reason that it didn't go well, because we didn't really have the supply chain for those modular parts. What we really are wanting to see are the smaller modular reactors and reactors that that basically require fewer capital cost inputs, and also these very interesting designs that would use molten salt as a coolant instead of water, that would just naturally shut down through convection processes if something goes wrong, that the fuel is already liquid, so it can't melt down. It would just end up going and freezing in the bottom of the reactor if something went wrong, like a loss of power or water. There's also potentially an opportunity to use our nuclear waste, our spent nuclear fuel, as a fuel source in these power plants. Again, there's just a lot of basic research, development, and demonstration that needs to happen before we would get there. So the IPCC has just pointed out in its 1.5 degrees C of warming report that nuclear is really not going to keep us there. And I agree with that, because we've still got quite a ways to go before we bring these truly advanced designs to market, if they work out at all. But I think we need to keep all of our options open because of the scale and scope of the challenge.
And so you talked a bit about R&D investment. And I gather, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of that is done from the private sector and not from the public sector? Or is the federal government, like in South Carolina, in those projects you mentioned down south, funding for that is mostly coming from the private energy companies, I gather?
Funding for the construction of the plant is, mm-hmm. for one of the plants, it is backed by a federal loan guarantee. So okay. if they do end up going bankrupt, the taxpayers will pay that off. So that is one type of policy support for advanced nuclear. But the research and development that I mentioned that needs to be done, that is mostly being funded by the federal government. And the federal government has a big role in that. We did see an increase in federal appropriations for Generation 4 nuclear in the last 2 years. So we'll see ARPA-E, which is the sort of Department of Energy analog to DARPA, in the Defense Department, has increased its funding for Generation 4 nuclear. But depending on who you ask, we probably have about $6 billion more that we would need to invest in R&D to really bring these truly advanced designs That's to market. Terrible. And that has to come from the public sector. There's private venture capital funding for advanced nuclear right now, but I just don't see that they have the capital necessary to really bring this design to market.
And so where do we, and one last question then, where do we stand in, as compared to other countries around the world in investing in alternative technologies, whether it's advanced nuclear or solar power or other types of green power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So China is doing a lot right now in electric vehicles, solar, wind, ultra high voltage direct current transmission lines, which would allow us to transmit electricity from renewables long distances to be able to match the centers of really good renewable resources with centers of demand. So China right now is kind of taking the U.S. leadership role in the climate change debate, which is something I think that is a lost opportunity for the United States, frankly. China's also done a lot in manufacturing of solar and helping to bring the cost down of solar modules themselves just through industrial policy. We've done a lot of the research in the U.S. and also in Germany for solar. China's done a lot to scale up the manufacturing, which has caused the World Trade Organization case in a debate about whether or not that was fair in terms of free trade, which it probably was not. It's looking like the decision will be. But Germany has done a lot with renewables, is one of the leaders in terms of the percentage of its portfolio for renewables, but Germany still has not quite figured out what it's going to do to back up intermittent renewables. It's still relying heavily on coal for that. It's looked potentially to the deserts of North Africa for large-scale kind of simulating base load dispatchable solar power, or the deserts of Spain. But basically, unless there's going to be a battery storage revolution, there's still that gap of how do we really scale things up. Spain has been a leader in large-scale solar, particularly in concentrating solar, so European Union in general. There are some countries in the Middle East and Africa, Morocco, South Africa, Saudi Arabia that are really stepping into the renewables space. A lot of it on the demonstration side. So there's a company in Saudi Arabia, Aqua Power, that's done a lot to bring the cost of concentrating solar power far down the cost curve in the last couple of years. So there's a lot of really good work going on around the world. I'd like to see the United States to continue to play a role as a thought leader and as a research and development leader as well.
Great information. Charlie, anything else to add? Any takeaways from all of this? Seems like we've got a ways to go in the field of energy.
Well,
sure.
I think what we do, there's plenty of work to be done. I got two things that I wanted to mention. You said quite correctly, that we need to worry about people who are caught in a transition. If you, mm-hmm. if you got some people who have built their lives around the coal sector, well, if we're going away from coal, we don't necessarily want to just say, oh, tough luck, buddy. And I think in the United States, generally, we have not done a very good job for people who are caught with technology changes or public policy changes. However, an awful lot of that transition has already happened because mm-hmm. due to technological changes in how we get coal out of the ground, the number of people who are actually working underground in coal mines is only about 5% of what it was a century ago. Mm-hmm. My other question was, it's now, gosh, it's 40 years ago, I think, I first learned about the plasma physics laboratory and attempts to do fusion energy. And back when I first heard about it, they said, you know, we're going to get to the point where we can do this at a commercial scale in about 30 years. Well, 30 years from 40 years ago was 10 years ago. And now I still hear, okay, in another 30 years. Do you think that'll ever happen?
I'm pretty skeptical about it. I don't think it's our best bet. There's some really fantastic experts on campus. Michael Murillo is one of them in our engineering department who have worked on fusion research and can tell you about the state of the art research. I've heard him talk about it. But for me, it would be better if we were putting that money into nearer term bets, because the challenge is so urgent, not just in terms of global climate change, but in terms of air pollution and sort of energy justice for our communities around the state of Michigan, that I think there are a lot of kind of lower tech, closer in ways that we could address this energy transition than fusion. I like the, you know, sort of basic fundamental knowledge that's coming from that. It's a really interesting science and engineering challenge, but I think that there are more practical near-term bets that we should be putting our funding into.
Super. Well, thank you very much for your work, Dr. Moore. I think it's a great example of how we at IPSR try to fold in applied research into public policy issues, making use of the State of the State survey and our Mapper grant program. Thank you very much for your work. Thank you again, Charlie.
Always a pleasure.
Join us again next month on State of the State when we'll have again some folks from campus talking about their research and work on issues involving Line 5. The continuing controversy on piping oil and gas under the Straits of Mackinac. Again, thank you to WKAR and Dr. Ballard. This has been State of the State.